Hello? Greg? Vanessa? Dylan Derryberry? Don? John Wasson? Anton? 11? Anybody? Is there anybody here with me? Or am I home alone? Macaulay Culkin, home alone face. Hello, everyone. It's just me this time. It's a special edition of Movies for When. This is what we call a soft launch for season 6. We're going to have a hard launch soon when we get to it. Life is busy. The reason I am home alone today is because, well, Greg is celebrating his anniversario. It's been 4 years of the Johnson Rivera family, and they are celebrating that magic, and man, we want them to have all the time in the world to do that. Vanessa was going to do this with me, and she got violently ill. We're sorry for Vanessa and wishing her recovery. She's actually doing a little bit better now, but not really in podcasting shape. And I have had just a hell of a fucking draining week, and I was just too exhausted to reach out and coordinate with someone like our beloved co-host Dylan Derryberry for our typical Friday the 13th absentee situations. And also, he's a parent and has a lot of stuff to do, so who knows if that would have even worked out. Anyway, here's the thing. Movies for When has never missed a Friday the 13th. Until now. We are dropping this on Saturday the 14th, which, in fairness, we were going to be covering Friday the 13th Part 3, which is set on Saturday the 14th. So this seemed like a fair thing to do until we decided, man, I'm not finishing this franchise without Greg. Friday the 13th is, or Part 3 is our last one to do. We've been working on going through this franchise on this podcast since the very beginning, and I'm not finishing without him, so I did Sleepaway Camp. We're going to cover, basically, once we finish Friday the 13th, we're still going to do special Friday the 13th episodes with who knows what, but probably a lot of adjacent movies, ripoffs of ripoffs, so to speak. And Sleepaway Camp is a fantastic one to start with. We'll get into why that is. But what you really need to know is the hard launch, the real season premiere of season 6, before we move past all of this Lion King 1.5 business, if you will, is going to be the Wenny Awards, formerly the Grenny Awards. It's the 5th annual Wennies. It's basically, it's like the Oscars for people who love movies. So we give awards for our podcast, and you'll be able to vote on them very soon, if not when you're already listening to the podcast. Just go to @movies4when, and there will be a link in the bio and probably some cool little slides about who's nominated. So this is always a really fun time of the year. We really enjoy this, and there's even a box where you can ask us any question you want, and if it's funny or cool, we will answer it on the show. So yeah, check us out at Movies for When, and we're going to dive right into this week's podcast. I will say, it might be a little shorter. Obviously, there's no one to talk back to me, which, you know, for my long-winded ass is an ideal scenario. I'm not going to lie. I'm just kidding. I miss Greg dearly. But just to buffer it a little bit, I was going to talk a little bit about what I've been playing, not just what I've been watching. So I'm going through a really big N64 phase. It's actually, my house is all packed up. We're looking to move as soon as we can. If anybody wants to buy a house, DM me on the Movies for When account. we only have the necessities out. Obviously, one of those things is an N64 on a CRT TV. So I've been playing, especially with March 10th recently occurring, I've been playing a lot of Mario 64. This is, like, I guess it's probably my favorite video game of all time. It's one of the first video games I ever played, one of the first I ever called my own. And it's definitely my biggest comfort game. Like, I can just sit down. Every so often, I swear, like, a couple times a year, I'll just, like, start a new game, get, like, 20 stars, beat the second Bowser, and, like, forget about it. But I just love playing that game, especially if I'm hitting up, like, those first couple levels, because I just played them so many times as a kid. I've been doing stuff I never had the patience to do. I've been looking for the 100 coins on every level. I might try to fully complete the game and finally meet Yoshi. My ADHD ass has never had a lot of time for slow-paced, tedious, methodical, detail-oriented stuff like that, but I'm actually kind of finding it fun, so maybe the meds are working. Speaking of comfort games, I've been playing Wave Race 64. For those who don't know, probably everyone, my video game history was, we had a Nintendo Entertainment System, and I'd been fucking with the original Mario Bros. And Duck Hunt. I think that we had one of those, like, game packs that came with that, and there was, like, some track and field game that we never played, but I'm, like, a child. I don't know what video games are. There's no internet. And then on Christmas, I just get, like, shadow dropped out of nowhere, a Nintendo 64 with Mario 64, Wave Race, and WCW NWO World Tour. To me, that's the holy trinity of video games, just because those were, like, the first three games that were, like, mine. And I just associate them with, like, so much happiness and so much fun playing N64, which was something that just blew our minds. And I was really surprised, because I have the Switch subscription to N64 games, largely because I keep forgetting to cancel it. You know, I played Mario 64 and Wave Race on that with some friends, and they were just, like, fucking unplayable games. I, like, couldn't imagine how I played these games when I was, like, 7 years old. Like, what the fuck was that? And I play them on the actual hardware of the N64, and guys, let me tell you, these games are just meant to be played with loose joysticks and somewhat unresponsive buttons, because, man, it was like a duck to water going back to these games on 64, and they are just impossible to play on Switch. But, man, if you like vaporwave shit at all, if you like mallcore, you know, like super millennia nostalgia through a rose-tinted lens, Wave Race is such a beautiful video game. Such a beautiful game. Instead of WCW NWO World Tour, I've been playing a ROM hack of the sequel called WCW NWO Revenge. For those who play the early AKI engine games on N64, the wrestling games, the WCW ones always had a bunch of fake wrestlers that had the move sets of notable Japanese wrestlers. And so Revenge is a fun ROM hack that puts the actual skins of the Japanese wrestlers with their move set and puts a whole bunch of other cool wrestlers that you can add to the classic Revenge game. I've done everything except lock, like, I've unlocked everyone except the last two. I need to do the television championship and the world championship, and can't wait to play as Mortis once I get that TV a TV title. But man, the main event of what I've been playing, ladies and gentlemen, I got a little bit of a story for you, okay? I got a story for you. Be me. Every so often I do something where I'm like, man, my ADHD ass just needs some sort of novelty right now. I need to do something cool. I need to do something new. And so money's tight because, like, it's America. Everybody feels that way for the most part right now. And I was like, man, I'm going to go out with $30. I'm going to find something to do for, like, the next week that's going to entertain me. And I don't know what it is yet, but I'll find it. So Vanessa and I go to Recycled Books in Denton, like, fantastic, fantastic place. I find, and don't get me wrong, disc only with some scratches on the, not on the playable side, they're tested and working, but scratches on the label side. $6 each, Grand Theft Auto Vice City, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. Obviously, $11 for both of those games is, like, stupid good. So obviously I'm picking those up. $11 after discounts. I can't add, but I do know 6 plus 6 is 12. Right? Anyway, so check it out. Greg graciously gave me his old PS3 in what, like, is insane for me to say. I don't remember exactly when it was, but I think it was over a decade ago now. And I've got a couple games I play on it, but I think I've widely just used it to play DVDs and specifically Blu-rays, because, I don't know, it was just the most convenient thing, so I suppose. Anyway, there's PS3s that are backwards compatible, and there are ones that aren't. And I am so sure that I have already checked that I have one that is, that I don't even bother to ask if I can play these PS2 games. It's like, I know it's a thing. I know I've already checked. Greg texts me and tries to tell me that it's not backwards compatible, and I don't believe him. Wouldn't you know it, it's not backwards compatible. So basically, I went back out and said, that was
different budget. That didn't count. Went back out with $30 again. And I went to CGX in Denton, and I got Turok for N64. Now, this is another childhood game, another really early one for me. Definitely one of the first ones I got after the Holy Trinity of the first three I just described. Turok is a Native American who hunts dinosaurs, and also there's humans. And boy, I don't know if they love dinosaurs or hate Native Americans, but boy, are they pissed off at me. Man, this is such a fun, weird N64 game. I'm on the third level, not a single line of dialogue explaining what's going on or why we're here. I'm having an absolute blast. It plays a lot like a PC title. It kind of reminds me of Wolfenstein. You use the C buttons to move, instead of the joystick. I'm having so much fun with this game, guys. It's really challenging. It's very unique in the sense that it's meant to be played like one playthrough. You obviously get to save, but you're not supposed to just hit a level and get a bunch of new lives. They strap you up when they strap you up, but like, I don't know. It's been really fun. I've really enjoyed it. I obviously can get a lot further than I could when I was a little kid, and I'm enjoying the challenge, and I'm having a great time. So what I've told myself is that once I beat Turok, I can buy a PS2. Which I don't know really how that's going to work in the budget, but it's easy. It's good news because Turok is hard and time is on our side, and I'll figure it out later. So that's the video games I've been playing, and now I'll move on to what movies I have been watching. I'll start with A24's How to Make a Killing, starring Glenn Powell. I believe it was EP'd by Glenn Powell, very Glenn Powell believing in himself project, or believing in the project himself, either way. It's a pretty cool movie. It's a movie about a dude who is basically estranged from his really rich family from birth. He realizes he is the heir to a really big fortune, and he starts killing them all off one by one. It's basically a little bit American Psycho, a little bit Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I kind of dug it. It's a solid, you know, middle range 3-star movie. It's not the kind of powerhouse A24 used to be, but I think that's just where we're at. Very much a fun little movie to watch. I don't know, you need to rush out to theaters to see it, but if you catch How to Make a Killing on streaming, I would recommend it. I also saw another movie, recent movie, Psycho Killer. It is a modern slasher. I rated it pretty high. I gave it, I think, probably a 41 out of 50. I was really surprised to see how low it was rated. I don't really understand it. I thought it was a really, really good modern slasher. It's kind of one of those mystery, like, why is this happening type of thing. So I won't say a whole lot about the plot. I do think that, like, the one note I had is just, like, must we always set up for sequels? But isn't that just also kind of the most classic slasher thing they could do, is set up for a sequel nobody wants to see? So I recommend Psycho Killer. It's got my seal of approval. Moving on, Greg and I are going to talk about some of these Oscar-worthy movies later. So I won't talk too much about Train Dreams until Greg is here. I will say I really enjoyed the themes of disharmony with nature and what that does to a human soul. And I really think what's interesting about Train Dreams is that there are sequences in it and sequences of photography where I would say, like, this is like elevated horror. It's not the kind of thing I expected in a movie about, like, industry's expansion to the West Coast of the U.S. I kind of expected just this, like, character-driven drama where people fall in love and trains are awesome, but no, this is, like, a very haunting movie. I can't wait to talk about it more with Greg. Additionally, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is nominated for some Oscars. I really enjoyed so much of it. I think there's a lot to love about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. It's definitely a very stressful movie, a portrait of a woman losing her mind. I choose to interpret a lot of it as like Lynchian dream sequence or dream logic, which I really enjoy. I think it's very well done, and that's another really great one to talk about with Greg. I watched a queer horror anthology, where since we're doing queer horror today, one I've been meaning to watch for a long time is Poison. Poison is, I would look up what year it came out, but my beloved cat Columbia is on my lap and sleeping on one of my hands, and I'm petting her with the other one, and I'm not a monster. I'm not going to stop doing that. I love my cat. I love myself. Poison is a horror anthology about some super gay dudes and just like the horror of alienation and self-hatred that comes with being gay. It's not coded. The characters are overtly gay, which is a pretty cool thing. That's especially something you don't see back in the day. Something I think that really worked about this movie that's kind of weird is it doesn't do like 1, 2, 3 separate anthology stories. It interweaves them all together with scenes stacked on top of each other. And when I heard that it did that, I was like, that sounds like ass. And it really found a flow. It really found a flow, a very different way to do an anthology. Something I would definitely recommend. I think you'll like it if you check it out. Up next, I watched Dragnet. Apparently that's like some fucking boomer show. I watched what I think is an 80s movie reboot of it with Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks. The reason I watched this is because I forget what movie, but Vanessa and I were at an Alamo Drafthouse pre-show where Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd do this rap music video about them being cops and catching this group of like insane cultists, and it was like hilarious and weird and bonkers, and we were like, holy shit, I gotta watch this movie. Guys, Dragnet the movie is fucking ass. Like, it's so shit. We could not wait for it to be over. It's one of those like 90 minute movies that feels like a 4-hour movie. The least said the better. It is not funny. It is not good. It is really boring. Don't watch it. I watched Kaiju Mono, which is a Japanese movie starring amazing professional wrestlers Kota Ibushi and Minoru Suzuki, two absolute highlights of 2000s and 2010s and even modern Japanese and on occasion American wrestling. When I saw that Ibushi and Suzuki turn into giants and fight kaijus, I said, I got to see this shit. The only way I could find it was buying a Blu-ray online and having it mailed to me. It's very hard to find streaming, at least in the U.S. It's even hard to find, like, pirated. It's also, like, a super small movie. Who said I would pirate things? No one does that. I meant on archive. Anyway, it's kind of a parody of classic kaiju movies. It's definitely, it definitely has that kind of, like, Sharknado feel. You know, like, they know that, like, giant wrestlers versus kaijus is not something done in earnest. It feels really funny, or really fun at least, and lots of it is like really good parody and really good homage. I think the problem with a spoof movie is making it go for 90 minutes and having it still be funny, which is like, you know, you've just got to be really good at it to do that. Airplane is, you know, one of the only successful ones. But it's pretty cool. There's like funny stuff about like, they have these magic undies. They like a dress like that clothes don't change sizes. So they have these magic stretchy undies that you can put on and you can turn into a giant in them and it'll be fine. And there's funny stuff like the bad guys are more interested in the fabric to make the undies than the recipe to make a wrestler turn giant. But it's a fun, shitty little movie. I liked it. I enjoyed watching it. Moving on to Scream 7. Guys, let me tell you. I've seen everything in the Scream franchise, and I can't tell you a goddamn thing about 4, 5, or 6. I do not remember them. I have not been interested in them. Scream 1 is one of the best horror movies ever made and does a really great job of deconstructing everything that just happened right at the end of the slasher craze. Scream 2 I thought was boring as fuck. Scream 3 I thought was a really fun rebound. I can't tell you anything about the other ones up until number 7. Guys, starring and executive produced by Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox. They brought in, oh, holy shit. What? There's a dude who basically wrote and directed this that was basically super involved with with the original movie. I can't look it up right now. Columbia's on my lap. It's a whole fucking thing. Trying to use AI on Google to find a simple fucking IMDb page is like a lost fucking practice. It's over. Anyway, it really is a fun movie, guys. Go see Scream 7. I was just having kind of a rough day and wanted to find a reason to get out of the house and go to the movies, because going to the movies makes me feel better. I thought this was a really fun movie. And it's like, I think what's so hard about Scream is that, like, the first one, its whole thing is it deconstructs, like, slashers. And it does, like, such an amazing job at it. And that's why it's such a good movie. And if it's what the franchise is known for, it's like, how do you keep deconstructing something that has already been so competently deconstructed? And I don't know, maybe if it's just been a while, maybe it's whatever, but Scream 7 had the feel of those original movies. You know, like, it had the feel of, like, hey, we're all having fun, we're all winking at it, but, like, this is, like, a smart movie. This is a well-done movie. So I really enjoyed Scream 7. And I'm sure I'll enjoy Scream 8, 9, and 10 if they still have this same kind of effort and same kind of people working on it. I think letting the, I think having like a creator driven, like people who've been deep in the franchise from the very beginning, I think that is the move. I hope that movie made a lot of money. And, I'll even say I went to a cool little thing at Alamo Drafthouse where they had this special opening night feature for movies premiering. If you went to the Thursday night premiere, after the Alamo pre-show, there was just like a little 8-minute thing of special content of people from the movie doing like cutesy little interviews. It wasn't like mind-blowingly cool or anything, but that was just a new feature at the Alamo Drafthouse that I thought was kind of cool and didn't cost anything extra. I don't think I have a season pass, so I don't know. Next up, I watched, Vanessa and I watched one of our favorite, comfort movies, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. We cover it, very early in the show on Movies for When You and Your Partner Can't Decide What to Watch. And here we are still doing that. Check out that episode if you want to hear more about Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So, man, I'm about to shit all over an indie movie, which is something I was really trying not to do. But oh my God, they made me do it. So I went and saw Matter of Time. Jesus Christ. First of all, this is what's crazy about it, especially local to DFW and being a nerd. 80% of this movie is like Sean Astin acting inside of Dallas Vintage Toys. Logos out, very much like, I did like a fucking double take. Like, it like hit me like a jump scare when that fucking Hobbit was in goddamn Dallas Vintage Toys, where Vanessa and I went like last weekend, and holy shit, they expanded a whole nother room. If you haven't been to Dallas Vintage in a minute, you should. They like opened warehouse space to make room for more stuff. It was an amazing experience. But what wasn't an amazing experience was watching this movie, even though they also featured some scenes at Nerdvana, which is a gaming bar cafe thing in the DFW area that friend of the show, Jason Hobbs of Kotoko Card Shop. Did I say that right? Kotoko Card Shop. Anyway, he's a Pokemon card dealer. You should check him out on Instagram. He's a childhood bestie of mine and an adult friend bestie. You will always be besties, Jason, if you're listening. Matter of Time. Other than the fact that those local spots are in it, guys, it's like if everything I hate about Kevin Smith, Big Bang Theory, and the MCU was somehow all mushed together and made somehow impossibly more grating to watch. I hated this movie. I hated every second of it. I hated every goddamn thing about this stupid, symbol-minded, smooth-brained, butt-fuck, dumbest shit, doesn't understand what fucking Batman's basic concept is despite being a super nerd. Shit fuck movie about a hate-worthy protagonist and just a bunch of shitheads doing dumb stuff all the fucking time. God, I hated them. Guys, there were two other people in this theater, and they both walked out. Now, it's something I haven't seen in a long fucking time. A theater walkout. And you gotta realize, I used to see people struggle and bravely do that when movies were like $2.50 on a Saturday afternoon. These people have gotta have paid like $18 to $25 for their fucking tickets. Do you know what it's like to walk away from an investment like that? And you know what? I was jealous of them. So Typically, I give any movie that's coherent a bare minimum of a 10 out of 50. But for Matter of Time, I docked 2 points for everyone who walked out of the movie and another point for everyone who wanted to, which brought it down to a 7 out of 50. You should only watch this movie if you hate yourself, but it would be better to go to the hospital and get treatment. Oh my God, I hated Matter of Time. Everyone who made this, stop creating forever. Thank you. Moving on, I saw John Woo's A Better Tomorrow at Alamo Drafthouse. It was so cool to see a movie with that kind of photography on such a big screen. I feel bad that I told people to stop creating forever. I wish I found a less mean way to say that, but I do mean it. Like, you need to, like, if you made Matter of Time, get help. Before you ever try to do something for an audience again, get help. Come to terms with whatever it is that made you either make or participate in this movie. Get help. And then get help with your creative work. Moving on. A Better Tomorrow by John Woo was really fun to see on a big screen. It was like John Woo. Honestly, all I've really seen of his work, I know he's like a very respected director of the action genre. I've obviously seen Face Off, and A Better Tomorrow is what brought him to the dance, one of his first really big hits, and it's made me want to see so much more of his work. I'd really like to take some time to sit down and see stuff like Hard Target and Killer and a few other of his cool ones. I saw an indie horror that I'm going to put over huge. I saw Dolly. Dolly is a cool movie. It's not by Dolly Parton. It's a movie about this character who has a doll mask who tries to capture people in the woods and torture them and mutilate them and also raise them as her babies. And I think what's really hard about a slasher movie is that you need to have a big iconic killer, and they can't be like any of the really well-known big iconic killers. And so when I first started looking at this, I was like, okay, it's Leatherface. It's a rotting meat-filled house. You know, it's Texas Chainsaw. Guys, it really has a more creative vision than that, and I'd really encourage you to stick with it. Sean William Scott is in this movie, and he is not acting like Sean William Scott, which is crazy. Ethan Suplee, or is it Suplee? I don't know. I follow him on Instagram. He's most notably Frankie from Boy Meets World. He has a character that brings a lot of fun and a lot of color to the movie. Fabian Therese is a more prolific actor that I haven't seen a ton of her stuff. She's in a lot of stuff. I just haven't watched a lot of it. She is the main character. She carries the team on her back. And her character, if there's an issue with the movie, it's in the writing of her character. Her performance is really good. But boy, is she a fucking dumb protagonist, and that's just the script's fault. I don't blame her one bit. So this is what's crazy. I was trying to look up who plays, I suppose Dolly is her name. And I seriously, like, this person had such a presence, and this movie had such interesting people, that part of me was like, this is Kane Hodder. Like, I didn't look it up, but this is going to be Kane Hodder. And so I'm looking it up, and it's some actor named Max the Impaler, and I'm like, kind of fucking actor names himself Max the Impaler? And then it hit me, it's an indie wrestler that I love. I've seen Max the Impaler perform multiple times. She is so fucking cool. She has so much presence. I once saw her at a WrestleCon show over a WrestleMania weekend that it was in Dallas. She was advertised to wrestle a bear in the main event of I think the Zicky Dice WrestleCon show that year, and the Twitter kept insisting it was a real bear, and part of me felt like I knew better, because this was at the Fairmont in Dallas. Part of me felt like they're not going to bring a real bear out to fight her, but they kept insisting it was. A friend of the show, Eric Sutherland, at the time, for a really long time, worked in AV at the Fairmont, and it was kind of a coincidence that I was going to a wrestling show and I actually caught him at work. And I just felt the need to ask him. I was like, hey, man, I feel like I know the answer to this question, but Were arrangements made, or were there any special precautions to bring a bear into this hotel today? And he was just like, fucking what? So I still on some level wanted to believe, but ultimately they sent out another wrestler in a bear costume. It was really fun, but kind of a letdown. I think if they hadn't insisted so much that it was for real going to be a bear, it might have been cooler. Anyway, Magsy Impaler is so badass, and she did such good physical acting in this movie. She doesn't have a line of dialogue, but her physical acting was, like, so fucking good. I just want to put over an indie wrestler who did a great job in a horror movie. What could someone like me love more than that? What can make me happy enough to crack a Diet Coke and say cheers to you, Magsy Impaler, and cheers to everyone involved in Dolly? That was really cool. Something that wasn't so cool. Huge letdown for me. It still hurts me to admit I didn't like it. But I didn't like it. Jesse Buckley in The Bride. Jesse Buckley is the Bride of Frankenstein. Christian Bale is Frankenstein. Directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal. Oh my god, did the trailers look cool. And that's because all the cool shit's in the trailers. This movie is not something I enjoyed. When you have a script so cringe that Jesse Buckley can't make it work. Oh my god, guys. Oh my god. Jesse Buckley's The Bride is basically Timeless Tony Storm from AEW with dialogue written for Captain Jack Sparrow, and it does not work. This movie is kind of intended to be a little bit Lynchian, like a little bit dreamy. Not everything's meant to play like natural, and that seems kind of fun, but it's also like, it seems kind of like choices made in post because the movie didn't work, and they didn't work either. Those might have been the vision all along. Jesse Buckley also plays Elsa Lanchester. This movie is supposed to basically take place inside the brain tumor of a dying... Or no, she doesn't play Elsa Lanchester. Jesus Christ, she plays Mary Shelley. This is basically supposed to take place in the brain tumor of a dying Mary Shelley. It's like, that's why it's a little bit crazy, a little bit kooky. I just felt really let down. I was really fucking excited for this, and it just sucked. It was a really annoying movie. It was hard to sit through. Moving on. What a bummer. I watched Friday the 13th Part 3D, but you can wait till November this year to hear me and Greg cover that movie. I'll probably watch it again before that. Guys, I don't know how much to tell you. I love committing to themes. I love doing themed things. And I was really ready to commit to March 10th, aka Mario Day, because Mar 10 spells Mario in leet speak. Really, you should throw a 4 on that A. Anyway, I woke up and played a little Mario 64. I had a bunch of stuff to do during the day. I thought at the end of the day, I'm gonna take a shower, I'm gonna put on my Mario Kart jammies, and I'm gonna watch Super Mario Bros. And I already know you can't stream it anywhere but archive, but I usually solve the problem because I bought a VHS and a DVD, but they're packed, but I've just got a plan in mind. It's gonna be nice. I don't want to get into it. It's not podcast material. I cannot tell you what a stressful day I had. I'm still recovering from just that fucking day. And that's why this is coming out on Saturday the 14th with just me by myself. Anyway, I did manage to get the movie started by the end of the day. I did watch it 2 days. I fell asleep. But guys, there's something really cool. On Archive, the 1993 Super Mario Bros. Movie, aka Cyberpunk Classic Super Mario Bros. Don't let anybody tell you anything different. There's an extended cut on Archive that has a bunch of stuff that was left out, and it is just so damn cool, especially if you're like me and you've been watching this movie since you were renting it at Blockbuster in childhood. Man, there's a lot more fun to be had in this extended cut, you know, and I think you definitely see just a whole bunch of little stuff where, like, they had to shave down 2 seconds and the shot didn't land as long or didn't hold for as long, but, like, there's also entire just like plot threads that got cut that make the movie a lot more fun. And finally, since yesterday was Friday the 13th, I watched Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, a.k.a. Jason vs. Carrie. That's already been covered on one of our old Friday the 13th episodes, but I will say it's definitely my favorite Jason design. Like, the way Jason looks in this movie is the most badass way Jason ever looks. So, anyway, that's what I've been watching. And we're going to move right on to the main event, the main attraction, what we're all here for, Sleepaway Camp, ladies and gentlemen. It's not Friday the 13th, but it's a lot like it. One of those things where Friday the 13th ripped off Halloween, then a bunch of other things ripped off Friday the 13th, and this is one of the more iconic ones. Sleepaway Camp is a queer horror. We're going to get into why. And spoilers ahead, if you haven't already seen it, there's a pretty big twist in the movie, so be careful. Anyway, we're going to start with what's usually Greg's duty. Critiker review of the week. Ladies and gentlemen, this comes from Critiker user Paxton. It says, makes meatballs look like wet, hot American summer. Wait. This movie has its fair share of fantastic one-liners, and also one very surprising one donger. Thank you for your thoughts, Paxton. We really appreciate you. A plot summary of Sleepaway Camp is basically our movie starts with a young boy and a young girl hanging out on a boat with their dad, and they really want to go to this camp that they see. And again, in a very wet, hot American summer-esque moment, like this, I know wet, hot American summer makes fun of just like tropes and like classic camp movies. Man, this one, I know it's just doing camp movie tropes. I know wet, hot American summer isn't spoofing this particular movie, but man, this one hits so many of the classic ones, like the capture the flag game and the baseball stuff. It like really, Wet Hot American Summer really has a lot in common with this movie. But basically, this counselor lets a kid drive the motorboat that is they're water skiing on, and a boat comes and kills the father and the young boy. The young girl goes to live with her cousin and her very interesting aunt, who has some very memorable performances in this scene. The girl and her cousin, what's her name? Jesus Christ. I have Lumby off my hand so I can actually look at stuff. The main character's name is, it's played by Felisa Rossa, I believe. Felisa Rossa. It's Angela. Jesus Christ, Angela. I've been hearing that name so much and I forgot it. Angela is the main character, the girl we follow. And what really sucks is that once these two finally get to go to summer camp, someone starts killing everybody, and it's a pretty formulaic camp slasher. There's some interesting things we'll get into about it. The big twist is that it's a mystery killer. No one knows who it is. And the big twist is it's Angela, and a trans person exists. Oh my God. It was actually the father and the little girl who died in the boat crash. The boy lived, and his aunt turned him into a girl, or whatever trans vernacular is more appropriate for something that I don't think was working to be too trans-affirming. But anyway, you see a penis on a feminine body. That's something, you know, I can't honestly think of another time I've seen that in a, like, theatrical release movie. So yeah, very interesting stuff. We'll get into the queerness of it and all that. But my relationship with the movie is that I've seen it once, and it was when I had COVID. Here's a fun fact. I had COVID the week of the shutdown. Like, I fucking got it right when everything happened. And there were no vaccine. There was no nothing. It was just raw, kick your ass, first wave COVID. I sub-quarantined in what was a prototypical version of the toy collection room. I sub-quarantined in there by myself to not give Vanessa COVID. Guys, for 3 days straight, I curled up in the fetal position on a love seat and didn't even feel like I had the energy to watch a movie. Once I did have movie watching energy, I started just being like, man, there's just been some shit I thought I might save for a special occasion that I'm just going to start checking off the list. And Sleepaway Camp was one of those movies. I liked it. I remembered all the major stuff. I didn't remember a lot of the details because I still had COVID when I watched it, but shit, that was like, what, 6 years ago now? Fuck. So I watched it again, and I enjoyed it both times. I like this movie. It's a fun movie. It's a scary movie, kind of. Not really. It's a queer movie. And bada boom, shall we do this? What's interesting about this being a queer movie is that in a lot of ways, it's like really transphobic. It's like the horror, a trans person exists, and you see that that she was forced into it, that she was put in this mold by a monster of an insane parent. And that's a lot of a really fucked up narrative about trans people. I think queer people are very used to seeing themselves coded into evil characters because of the Hays Code era. And I think, you know, one way to look at this is just like overtly transphobic. But I think the way most people look at it is kind of a homage to the Hays Code era, in the same way that Rocky Horror Picture Show is kind of an homage to that era, and sort of looking lovingly at a time in which oppression was more literally mandated. And so I think, generally speaking, queer people and horror fans and just the massive overlap of that demographic looks at this movie pretty lovingly. I think it's like a really fun, like, the horror, a trans woman. Oh, my God. I think we like to pretend to clutch our pearls over that, don't we? It's really fun. If I don't speak for you and you do have problems with this movie, I don't mean to speak for you, and maybe you could talk to me about it and help me understand a little more your perspective. Anyway, a little bit of trivia is that for a long time, obviously Angela, so they make a really good face cast of her, of the young girl, Felisa Rossa. I hope I'm saying that right. 1L means Felisa, not Felisa, right? Oh, wait. No, 1L means Felisa, I think. Let's say Felisa Rose. God, Rossa. Jesus Christ. Felisa Rose. Sorry if I got your name wrong, Felisa. I'll hit you up at a con. A cast was made of her head that is really convincing, and it was put on the body of a young actor in his 20s. Famously, the actor wished to not be credited because he had cold feet, so to speak, on the set, and he didn't want to do it. He had to get really, really drunk to go put the cast on and bear his wonderful wiener for the whole world to see. So he asked to not be credited, and for a long time it was a mystery who played him. I've recently looked up the trivia, and apparently it's someone who you can't find any other information on named Archie Liberace. Archie Liberace, if you're a real person and not a made-up name that someone typed into some fucking trivia machine, please identify yourself. What kind of... If you're Archie Liberace, you... Like, how did you live a low-key life with such a high-key name? That's interesting to me. Having a sip of coffee and moving on to the main body of the show, I do think this is going to be a lot slower or a lot shorter because I don't have anybody to chop it up with, but... We'll see how it goes here. I thought it was very interesting that in the first scene, the original Angela is wearing a trans flag bathing suit. The colors are that of the trans flag. And I honestly haven't looked up my history of when that flag was adopted, but whether that's coincidence or intentional, that's pretty cool. I think this is something that it has in common with the first Friday the 13th movie, is that the killer is a mystery. Something it also has in common with Friday the 13th is that if you use the fridge logic of being like, wait a minute, spoilers for Friday the 13th, if you haven't seen it, part one, spoilers, it's actually cool, go watch the movie, Friday the 13th part one is good, spoilers, the killer is Pamela Voorhees, and she appears to be like a middle-aged woman, and she's apparently been throwing motherfuckers around and performing feats of strength. And that's not something I thought of immediately when I watched the movie, but it is something you think about later when you're like, wait a minute. And with the killer being revealed to be a tween-age girl, she's like stabbing through shower walls to kill people with a knife and doing insane feats of strength. And they also had... a male do all the hand work, so it wouldn't look so much like a feminine hand when you see like the knife that the killer's holding in the shot or whatever it is. So it kind of has both of those things in common with Friday the 13th, obviously being a horror movie set at a summer camp, it has something in common with Friday the 13th. I also think that, like, people need to talk more about how in the 80s, you know, like, the cultural fear that was expressed in a lot of slashers is that the Reagan-era conservatives were culturally and also politically and legally stomping all over, like, the free love of the 60s and the 70s, and everything was going back to, like, suits and corporate places, and to quote Big Lebowski, the war was over and the bums lost. As one of the bums, I say, fuck that, we're just resting. But ultimately, I think you see Jason Voorhees killing a lot of, like, gay and sexually liberated characters, and that's a metaphor of, like, the fear that you can't go out and be yourself anymore. And I think having the killer be a trans woman, and just, like, the whole movie, you just see her isolated. You see her not, like, othered by the other girls. She's just, like, staring off into space, knowing that she feels like if people knew her secret, holy shit, what would happen? So anyway, that's kind of a you know, like, the fear of the conservative culture taking back over the U.S. And so I think you see that, and that's really cool. I would say one of the big differences from Friday the 13th is that kids are at this camp, and the kids are in danger. I believe it's only Friday the 13th, Part 6. Dylan Derryberry, please fact check me on that. Where kids are at the camp, and even then, you just kind of have Jason kind of flirt with danger with the kids. I think he walks through a cabin, you know, like he kind of seems to be looking at this one little girl through a window and stuff like that. And the kids are in danger in this movie, not just from the killer, but from, like, the real life pedophiles that are established as a threat almost instantly when they get to camp. Man, guys, one of the last true taboos in film, other than seeing trans bodies naked, there we go, is violence towards children. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that is a good taboo. I'm not saying you can't put stuff like that in a movie. I'm saying if you put something like that in a movie, you should be aware of how it makes audience members feel, and you should be taking it seriously, and you should be portraying it with taste and for an artistic reason that accomplishes a goal. I don't know that's true in this movie. Guys, I'm gonna be honest, there's a fucked up scene. We don't see this happen. We see the bodies. A bunch of children get fucking massacred in this movie. And I don't know. I mean, like, it's not the kind of movie where you take what you see seriously. I get that. And a lot of these old slashers have things in them, like sexual assault, that should be taken a lot more seriously than they're portrayed. But that was really interesting in this movie. And I mean, even, I guess, a child dies in the first scene through boat bonking. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that in a movie like Sleepaway Camp. You tell me. How do you feel about it? Like, share, and subscribe. I'm like a YouTuber now. Leave it in the comments on our RSS feed. Is there comments? I don't think there's comments. If there's comments, leave one. About anything. I don't care. I'd love to hear it. So there's a really big thing that needs to be established. First of all, we saw a pedophile instantly turned into Cain, through burning, in a moment of instant karma for, trying to victimize children. Man, a pedophile being turned into Cain. That's what I like to call libertarianism. Vanessa was gonna do this podcast. She was starting to feel better. I wasn't gonna even ask her to do this, but she was watching this movie, and she's gotten, you know, sicker since. But when that pedophile cook is cooking in the kitchen, he has, like, a comically oversized Bugs Bunny stew making pot on the stove. Vanessa, if you guys don't know Vanessa, she is a fucking wizard in the kitchen. Oh my god, I hope one day you have the joy of having a meal prepared by her. She's just like an absolute Iron Chef. And she got so mad in this scene that she wanted to do the podcast, just because, like, it's an outdoor cooking pot, and there's a lot of reasons that would never happen. She was adamant. She thought that the cook was going to go up and over into it, which would have been funny, but I just want to at least express Vanessa's outrage at that scene. That is not how cooking works. As someone who also doesn't know how cooking works, even I thought it was an oversized cooking pot. Man, this movie is very interesting because the kills in it are not very good. You don't really get to see much in the kills, to be honest. There is a really fucking good arrow through the throat scene that's like, damn, how did they do that? It was really cool. I'm not going to say there's no good kills, but what is really good about this movie is all of the, like, horror body cast that they make. I already mentioned the famous one in the finale of the movie. There's also just, like, that burned-up pedophile dude I was talking about. There's also, in a scene that is hilarious, a very small beehive takes this man's life while he's shitting. And apparently in just a matter of moments, they completely eat into his fucking body cavity and they're like crawling in and out of him. And it looks like amazing and it's like super fucked up and cool. Great effect. It's like, what fucking kind of bees do you guys have at this camp? Let's put the goddamn killer thing on hold. What bees are those? But that was a really funny scene, especially if you love Nicolas Cage as much as we do, and you start screaming things like, killing me won't bring your honey back. It's important to have things like that in your life, I think. Vanessa hadn't seen this movie. And her guess of who the killer was that it would be a tag team between Angela and her cousin, and that's about as close as a person can get. She thought it was a Scream situation. She basically guessed the movie. And you know, guys, I know this isn't an extremely long discussion about Sleepaway Camp, but I'm kind of here running out of notes, to be quite honest with you. Just to riff a little bit about it, as it compares to other slashers of the era, I like that it doesn't have a holiday. Because here's a fun fact, guys. So basically, Halloween was a really big success. And then Friday the 13th was a really big success. And the Hollywood algorithm, aka the dipshits who make decisions at studios, were like, wow, people really love, they love horror movies set on holidays. So that's why you have so many movies like Mother's Day and April Fool's Day and Thanksgiving and all this stuff. And what they totally misunderstood is, no, people like atmospheric horror with larger than life killers. The holiday thing was a coincidence. They like Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers. And I think this movie, I just appreciate that there's not, like, a masked killer in a holiday. I think that really does differentiate it a little bit from other movies of the time. While I think this is, like, definitely B-movie quality, it's not something that's, like, so stupid you can't take it seriously. Like, the movie is taking itself seriously. It has some, like, wild stuff in it, like the bee scene that I just described. But it's still, like, it's a good movie. Is it a scary movie? No, not at any point is it a scary movie. But it's definitely more fun and seems to have more to say than a lot of just, like, the empty, stupid slashers of the era. So I'm a fan of Sleepaway Camp. I think most people who watch it would be. I'd love to hear what Greg's opinions are if he ever watches it. But from there, I think I'm going to go into gimmicks. We will start with my favorite kill. I decided that since we're still sticking with a Friday the 13th theme, except this one is movies for when is it Friday the 13th? Because it's Saturday the 13th. It's whatever. Oh, Columbia's back. Hello, darling. We're going to stick with favorite kill. I will say that the first kill in the movie being something that was basically a theme park stunt show, bonk on the head kill, was really fun. I think my favorite is when we get the reveal of the canoe corpse with the snake in its mouth. There was just something so cool. I know that's like a really stupid thing, but that really worked for me. Nessa voted for the death by bees. That was her favorite kill for a lot of obvious reasons. My favorite line, I'll give a runner-up to, do you have to kiss so wet? Which I thought was a hilarious thing to say. And finally, my favorite line is, eat shit and live, Bill. because that's inspirational. You know, it's like at the end of Hook, instead of to die will be an really awfully big adventure. That's what it is. And then they're like, no, dog, to live will be an awfully big adventure. So yeah, eat shit and die is, you know, it's what we've all heard a million times. But man, eat shit and live. God damn, I believe in something again. My rating for this movie is a 31 out of 50. That's a passing grade with a little extra pizzazz, a little extra razzle dazzle for you. And yeah, I guess that's where we get off the sleepaway camp train, and we move into our farewells. We love you all. It's been a beautiful podcast. We are really looking forward to our next episode, which will be the hard launch of the season 6 premiere of the Winnie Awards. You can vote for the Winnies on our Instagram account at Movies for Win. Check out our stories. Check out the link in our bio. If they're not up yet, they'll be up before long. So get excited for next week or next whenever. And we'll return soon with Greg Johnson. For Greg Work, the not-so-secret stash Johnson, I'm Denny, the vote in the Winnies, Taylor, and this has been Movies for When. Is it Friday the 13th? We already told you when it's Friday the 13th, but you know what we didn't tell you? What's my cage again?
I'm a policeman. See my badge?
Stay.